This is Marathon Training Academy, episode 38.
Hello, welcome to Marathon Training Academy, found online at marathontrainingacademy.com. I'm Trevor.
And I'm Angie.
In this episode, we interview Dr. Robert Mackey, a weight loss expert who has helped thousands of people drop the pounds without surgery, fad diets, or appetite suppressants. And at the end of this episode, Angie throws down some quick tips about running in hot weather. And if you like what you hear on our podcast, then you can become a member of the Academy and get instant access to all our courses, interviews, and back episodes. You can get a 14-day trial membership by visiting our site, marathontrainingacademy.com/member. So, Angie, you're in quite the marathon mode here of late.
Yes, I am. I have been dreaming of marathons.
Signing up to all kinds of marathons every day.
Everyone I can get my hands on, that's right. I'll have to tell my body they're going to have to run them. But yes, I signed up for the Wine Glass Marathon in Corning, New York. And that takes place the 2nd of October. And it's been one I've had my eye on for a while. It's a nice, flat, fast course. They advertise that 30% of the people who run it qualify for Boston, and 50% of people who run it do a sub-4 marathon. So, you know, I'm hoping to maybe PR this fall, and I think that'd be a great opportunity.
And your sister signed up for it, too.
Yes, Autumn, whom you guys may have remember from a past podcast. She did the Little Rock Marathon with me in March, and she signed up for it, too. So I'm really excited to be able to do another race with her.
And she'll be a married woman by the time that race comes around.
Yes, she will. So her new husband will be there to cheer her on.
Well, and since running her first marathon in March, has she ran much at all?
She's been running, but she really hasn't had a goal. She's excited about having this race in the calendar to help her stay focused. And I think it's common, you know, after a person gets married or any big life event, you know, sometimes let exercise
fall by the wayside.
Right, right. You know, kind of the famous newlywed 15 or the college 15 pounds, you know, that can happen. So I don't think that's going to happen to her, but this will be a great goal and something to look forward to even after the wedding.
And sometimes people, after they run their marathon, if they don't have another race planned, their running kind of dwindles down. And some of them maybe even get to the point where they're just not running that much anymore. And so keeping a race on the calendar is a good way to keep your running base built up.
Exactly. Even if you don't have a desire to do another marathon right away, even having a 5K or a 10K or a half marathon to train for and to look forward to can really breathe new life into your running.
All right, so last weekend you ran the Paducah Iron Mom Half Marathon in Paducah, Kentucky. So how did that go?
It went great. A few days before, I had hurt my back picking up our infant son, who is rather weighty.
Yeah, he's a solid little dude.
Yes. So I ended up having to go to the chiropractor that week, and he's like, "You want to run a half marathon this Saturday?" Like, yes, can you get me fixed up? My back was feeling okay by race day, but, you know, not 100%. So I knew between that and the hot weather that it probably wouldn't be my best race.
Mm-hmm.
But I still managed to
finish under 4 hours.
Yeah. Yes. 2 hours shy of 4 hours.
You finished under 2 hours.
Yes, I did.
Yes, awesome.
And I was happy. I mean, there was a point in the race that I was wondering if I would. It was tough the last 3 miles, but I knew that I had it in me and I could do it.
And this was a smaller race. Parking was extremely convenient. And my son Riley, who's 6 years old, ran his first race. It was a 1 mile kids run. And you ran it with him.
I did.
Other kids with me. So maybe we should get him on here to talk about it.
Yeah, it would be good to interview him about his race.
Let's pause this thing and I'll go get him.
Okay.
Okay, well, we have Riley here now, our six-year-old son who ran his first race. It was a one-mile race. Riley, did you have fun?
Yes, I did.
Did you have to do any training for your race?
Yes, I had to do 1 mile a day, so that was good. Very good.
Okay. What was your experience like during the race?
Can you tell us about it? Can you describe it?
Well, it was hard and I had to run and I was really sweating, so I felt good to be doing the race, and when I finished, I got this medal.
Are you an Iron Mom?
Well, Mom's an Iron Mom. I'm an Iron Boy.
So what was it like to finish the race? Was it exciting when you went across the finish line?
Yeah. It was like everyone was cheering at me and looking. I was like running.
You're running as fast as you can?
No, I was just doing a pace I have.
Okay. You had a smart pace that you were running.
Yeah.
That's good.
So.
Did you run faster when you saw the finish line, though?
Yeah, I did cross that finish line.
Good.
And the time said 100.
100, okay.
Yeah, it said 100.
Do you remember that, Angie?
No, I don't. There was lots of numbers up in that clock, huh?
Yep, lots of numbers.
So what about after the race? Did you get any food afterward or anything?
Yeah, I got a cookie, got some water. I got to go down to the river, and it was a good race. A really good race. I am hoping forward to do lots more races in my life, so...
So. Sounds good. Maybe you'll run a marathon with Daddy and I someday, huh?
Yep. It'll be a good marathon.
So do you know how long a marathon is?
Well, 26.2 miles.
All right.
That's how long a marathon is.
So, Riley, do you know what a podcast is?
Well, a podcast is this thing where it's on a computer. Sometimes it can be on a computer, and... You have a white snowball, and then you talk into it, and it shows up on the computer what you say. And then you can record it online, and you can get fans by... They just listen to your podcast, they would like it. They become a fan.
Right.
And right now, Mommy, how many fans do you have?
Well, on Facebook, we have almost 3,000.
Well, on Facebook, they almost have 3,000 fans. That's a lot of fans.
Would you be one of our fans if you were on Facebook?
Certainly, certainly, yes.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Riley, for coming on the podcast and letting us ask you some questions about your race. We're really proud of you, buddy.
That's right. You did a good job.
Say thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all that have been listening to this podcast.
I think we have a little host in the making, don't we?
That's right.
All right, Angie, have you been hearing back from anybody lately about their running life?
Yes. I love to hear people's comments and success stories on our blog, and it's also great to connect with people on Facebook. So if you have a chance, go over to our Facebook page or our blog and leave a comment. This first shout-out goes to Melinda, and she says, "Hi, Angie. I'm a new listener to your podcast and can't get enough of them. I've listened to almost all of them and bought your ebook, all of which are inspiring. Not just for running, but also for life. As long as I can remember, I've had a desire to run a marathon, and I always thought that marathoners had to be half crazy to torture themselves in that way. I'm now thinking that maybe it's half the fun, to be able to let go and just do it. Since I was young, I've enjoyed playing sports, and in high school, they said we should run to be stronger, and I would cringe inside. I could think of many more things to do that I'd enjoy, and rarely would go running. Since my high school days, I've run sporadically, and recently joined a gym. The desire somewhere deep inside of me to run a marathon keeps coming. No matter how many spin, Zumba, body pump, or yoga classes I take, the desire to run a marathon won't leave me. After searching the internet and doing what I could to learn the basics, thanks mostly to your podcast and ebook, I decided that I have nothing to lose. This past Saturday, I began to build my running base. I've even convinced my parents, age 77 and 73, to start a walk-run program with me. I'm anxious, nervous, and excited to see where this will take me." I wanted to share that because she's a newer runner, and she's had that desire to run a marathon, and she's taking action and pursuing that goal, and even inspiring others to get active and healthy like her parents. So I think that's really neat.
Well, she says that she used to think runners or marathoners had to be half crazy to endure the torture of training for a marathon and running all those miles. So what do you think, Angie? You think marathoners are half crazy?
Well, you're talking to a marathoner, so
you should
I don't think I'm crazy. Do you really think I'm crazy? Do I sound crazy? No, don't answer that. I mean, I think it depends on your perspective. You know, if it's uncomfortable for you to even run a mile, the thought of running 26.2 miles seems crazy, fantastic.
Like superhuman.
Yeah, it does. But you have to start small. You start building up your running base. You get so you can run those 3 miles comfortably and you sustain that for a while. And then you go through a training plan that incrementally builds you up to that distance. So, you know, once you've run 18 or 20 miles in your training plan, 26.2 miles seems hard, but it doesn't seem crazy anymore.
Uh-huh.
So it kind of depends on what lens you're looking through, I guess.
Yeah, to me, since I haven't done a marathon yet, I've only done a half, two halves.
That's right.
Well, it makes a marathon, doesn't it? But it still seems like a big distance, or a huge distance, and I have doubt.
Yeah, but it doesn't seem crazy to you anymore, does it?
No, but it seems hard.
Yeah, it is hard. And we're not denying the fact that it is hard, but it is doable if you have the right preparation.
Yeah, that's what I just keep telling myself is I'm going to build up to it, and by the time my marathon comes in October, I'm going to be ready because I have followed the plan, I've trained properly, and worked my way up to the 26.2 miles.
That's right. The second shout-out comes from Kate. She says, "My name is Kate, and I'm from Alberta, Canada. I just ran my first full marathon yesterday in Calgary, and I made it, 4 hours and 42 minutes. I was freaking out about it for months, and especially the 2 weeks prior to the race. My husband always listens to podcasts in the truck, and he mentioned to me that I should find some to listen to. That's how I stumbled upon yours. 2 weeks ago, on a long drive down to Montana, I listened to about 4 of your podcasts, and I loved them. I love the quote you said, 'No one likes hearing about things you didn't do.' Anyway, I just wanted to say it was an awesome experience. My whole family came out for the race, and I got to throw my 16-month-old little cute monster on my shoulders and run across the finish line with him. Needless to say, it's rarely about the running, because now I feel like I can do anything. And sometimes a stay-at-home mom needs to be reminded of that."
Well, it's good stuff. It sounds like she found our podcast right at the right time. Was able to get some encouragement from it, and that's why we're doing what we do. But I don't remember you saying, "No one likes hearing about the things you didn't do." Do you remember saying that?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. I don't know what episode you said that on, but...
I don't know either.
I like that quote, though.
Yes. I mean, a lot of times people talk about what they want to do, and, you know, that's great to an extent to have goals and dreams, but at some point you need to start putting feet to your goals and accomplishing them. And we're glad to be here for the new runner and the marathoner alike, so... It's great to hear about your success, Kate.
Yes, and congratulations to all of you who are living the healthy and active life, whether you've been a runner for a long time or just getting into it. Just keep on going, because you do have what it takes. Well, in this episode, we are going to play an interview that we recorded with a friend of mine who I first met in kind of an online mastermind group for entrepreneurs. His name is Robert Mackey. He's a weight loss expert. This is the first episode that we've ever done on weight loss. So, Angie, maybe you could say a word about, you know, how weight loss synthesizes with marathon training.
Yes, that's right. Many people, we'll just kind of go back before even marathon training, many people start running to lose weight. And as we all know, running burns a lot of calories. It can be a great way to help you get fit and, you know, start taking better care of your health and everything. And I do hear from a lot of people who are still struggling with their weight loss. They've maybe been running for a little while, from, you know, a couple months to a few years, and they're still struggling with some pounds. So running isn't an automatic way to lose weight. And some people wonder, I hear I'm doing all this activity and exercise, why can't I get down to where I want to be? So maybe this is just what you need to hear to help you along on your weight loss journey.
And Robert has a very unique perspective. I guess you could say it goes against conventional wisdom that's out there right now in the weight loss marketplace, and I think everybody's going to enjoy it.
That's right.
All right, we are on the podcast today with Dr. Robert Mackey. He is a naturopathic doctor and weight loss expert with a private practice in San Francisco. He's helped thousands of patients lose weight without surgery or appetite suppressants. And Robert also hosts a weight loss podcast called The Dr. Rob Show. And you can find him at www.drrobertmackey.com. So, Robert, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So we'd like to know a little bit about your background, and maybe you can tell everybody what led you to specialize in helping people lose weight.
Sure. Well, part of it started out with my own struggle. After high school, I put on some weight and got into college, and I really struggled in my mid-20s. I moved away from the Midwest and went out to the West Coast, and I went into actually started medical school, and was in that process of trying to lose the weight that I gained. I gained about 40 or 50 pounds or so, and really had a hard time doing it. I subscribed to all the same information everyone else does: eat less, exercise more, and I was really kind of beating my head up against the wall because it wasn't working. So with my training, I was in medical school at the time, so I started doing my own research and kind of trying to figure this problem out. And lo and behold, I was able to figure it out, and I started realizing how different what I did was compared to with the information that everyone else hears and sees. The weight loss industry kind of tells people, in some ways, the wrong information. People do it religiously, but they don't really get the results that they want.
Yeah, you definitely see, instead of the obesity epidemic getting better, it seems to be getting worse. So there has to be some kind of disconnect there, definitely.
Yeah, it's almost like the information that's being promoted, again, that eat less, exercise more, it's all based on calories, energy in, energy out, is really only making the problem worse. So my perspective or my approach to that is to, again, 180 degrees different, and focus on the real underlying problem. And that really what naturopathic medicine is all about, which I'm sure a lot of your listeners probably don't know what that is. But I went to a school in Seattle called Vassar University, which is kind of one of the leading institutions for natural health education. And it has one main philosophy that the body, you take away obstacles to cure, whatever that might be, diet, lifestyle, certain other toxins, whatever it might be, and the body will do the rest. And, weight loss certainly is a challenge. It's not necessarily always easy as we want it to be, but once you do that and you fix some of the biochemistry and metabolism errors, then the body will do what you want.
Yeah, I hear from many people who have started a running program, so they're physically active, but they still struggle to lose some extra pounds. In your experience, what are the key factors that prevent people from losing weight despite being on an exercise program?
Well, as I said just a second ago, one of the main problems is that people still focus way too much on calories. Again, they try to limit. The first thing that everyone does when they want to lose weight is they eat less, as I said, and they exercise more. So that means they intentionally try to starve themselves, and they start a particular exercise program. Typically, that means aerobic exercise of some sort, whether that's training for a marathon, whether that's going on the treadmill, the elliptical machine, something along those lines. And the easiest way to gain weight is to start a diet. I have one rule in my practice with my patients is that the larger the person is, the less they need to be on a diet. And, that there's needs a little bit of explanation, but if you're severely overweight, 50 pounds or more, the last thing you should do is to be intentionally restricting your calories. The body's too smart for that.
Yeah, that's interesting because, you hear about these low-calorie diets and, it really seems like it's not really a safe and effective way to lose weight, at least for the long term. Is that what you found?
Yeah, that's exactly why I don't do that, because it will produce, and the weight loss industry is geared around producing short-term results. So what I mean by short-term, anything in the first month to the first 6 months. And if you look at a lot of the programs that are out there that we've all heard of or have tried or your listeners have tried, you lose weight fairly rapidly in that first 3 to 6 months, but then the second 3 to 6, usually at 12 months, people have either gained all the weight back or they've actually put on an extra 10 or 20 on top of what they lost originally. Because I said, the body's too smart for caloric restriction, so you're actually priming the body for weight gain by actually going on that caloric restricted program. And again, we won't need to get into all the details of that, but that's why it's almost inevitable that people are going to regain that weight.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I have taken a lot of questions from listeners, and we'll hopefully get into some of those a little bit later. And, that could be part of the problem with, not losing losing that weight and maintaining the weight loss over the long term. Now, I know, personally speaking, my biggest weakness as far as eating is sugar. So my question is it possible to be addicted to sugar? And I kind of think I know the answer to this, but what steps should a person take to break a sugar addiction?
Yeah, that's a great question. You're not alone, by the way. Everyone, for the most part, we're all addicted to sugar. Our brains are kind of designed that way to, you know, that's what we run on. Our brain runs on glucose. So that's going to be the first thing that we look for all the time. Now, how to break that, what I call the processed food vicious cycle, is there needs to be a level of abstinence from those types of foods, whether that's actual sugar itself or refined fructose corn syrup, artificial sweeteners, all those different types of things all play into the sugar refined carbohydrate realm. And a simple rule, the more you have, the more you want. That's the way that we're hardwired to, when the food's plentiful, we keep eating. And that's why sometimes people's appetites becomes almost insatiable. You throw in a little bit of stress into that, and now it's even doubly so. So there needs to be a period of time, whether that's a few weeks, a few months, you know, it's hard to say on the given person, but those processed foods and quote-unquote sugar need to be eliminated for a period of time. And I tell all my clients, they kind of freak out when I tell them that because they're so emotionally attached to those foods, which is a big red flag that it's causing you some problems. When you're unable or unwilling to let that food go, you have to really look at that and understand why, because there's biochemical reasons why you're craving those foods so much. And then once you've been away from it for a period of time and everyone's a little bit different, those cravings minimize substantially. Usually it's within the first anywhere from 5 to 10 days is when it's the hardest. Once you get past that hump, then you can actually, you stop thinking about it all the time, and you can get on with your normal daily functions.
So as long as you warn everybody in the immediate vicinity that you're going off sugar,
right,
to bear with you. And
yeah, you'll be a little cranky for a couple of days. Your energy might drop a little bit. You might actually get a headache. You might get some nausea. But if you really look at that and understand what that is, it's basically withdrawal symptoms.
So you basically think cold turkey is the best way to go about it, huh?
Well, that's a very good follow-up question. No, not necessarily. If someone is, and I worked with a lot of people that are, let's say, 100 pounds overweight, they need to lose a substantial amount of weight, they have to be kind of gradually brought into that process.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, the bigger the person is or the longer they've been overweight, you don't want to go from 0 to 60 as fast as you can. You want to gradually work that process down, because all you're doing otherwise is you're ensuring their sabotage or their failure rate by doing it too aggressively, too quickly. So, there's definitely ways to do that, starting with the highest priority things first, and then little baby steps over time, and then eventually you get to a point where there's nothing at all. And that process may take anywhere from a few weeks to a few months, sometimes, even up to a year, depending on the person.
So I guess the goal is to, have compliance in the long term instead of just, making all these radical changes for a couple weeks and then the person falling off the wagon and being discouraged and giving up kind of thing.
Well, right. And that's the other thing that I try to coach my patients about, is that we have to be realistic about how long it's going to take to lose weight. Okay, now we see a lot of TV shows, which are fantastic and they're great drama, but the amount of weight that they lose on a week-to-week basis, we're not watching it in real time, but the amount of weight that we see them lose is very unrealistic, what really happens. So people try to reproduce that in their own lives, and they get discouraged when they're not losing 10 pounds a week, and they can't stick with the process long enough. So that's the first thing that I do is, depending on where they're starting from, is if you're not willing to commit a certain amount of time, this is going to be a very challenging thing. And keep them focused, keep their motivation high, hold them accountable, and then usually, all those things happen. So, my whole, I guess, philosophy is, what's good is it losing 30, 40, 50, 100 pounds if you regain back that plus 10 more? The goal is to lose it and then to keep it off forever, hopefully.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So what do you think of Diet Coke, Dr. Rob?
Occasionally, I don't have any problem with it whatsoever. There's no food that I think is taboo at all. I think that we do live in a very abundant society, that we have a lot of access to a lot of great food that tastes really good. However, those types of things have to be few and far between, whether it's, you know, Diet Coke or whether it's alcohol or whether it's whatever. And that's the point where I usually try to get people to, is to get them to a point where they can enjoy those things on an occasional basis. I call it the 80-20 rule, which we've all heard of before in other areas, that if you nourish yourself and you follow a particular strategy 80% of the time, that other 80%, or excuse me, the other 20%, it doesn't really matter much. You can have your proverbial cake and eat it too, and it's really not going to upset the landscape of your body too much, and you're going to stay in that fat burning mode that everybody wants.
Sounds good. I'll be right back and we'll get one.
Like I said, that's not a big deal at all. People think sometimes I'm like the food police, and it's really not like that. You know, there's time and ability and space to enjoy it all. It just has. Now, if you, let's say, for example, you're diabetic or you have some major health concern, you know, then maybe it might not be so appropriate for certain things. But occasionally, I don't see a problem with it at all.
All right, well, I have the next question. Does lack of sleep and stress make it more difficult to lose weight? What do you recommend to a person who is struggling in these areas?
Well, my three main roadblocks that I see now there's a lot of factors and it's very multifactorial and we won't go into all of them, but three of the major ones, we touched on sugar a little bit. That's probably number one. Stress, which is probably number two, and those two are kind of neck and neck. And the third is definitely lack of sleep. And we live in a very sleep-deprived society, 24/7, 365, and that the same hormones that control sleep are the same hormones that control appetite and metabolism. So if you're not sleeping, then your brain says, well, I might as well be eating. And it's a great way, if you get a nice, long, healthy sleep, it's a great way to manage your appetite without having to manage your appetite. There's some very particular hormones that are affected when you're not sleeping well. So that's a big problem that I focus on with my clients, is to get them to sleep earlier and not trying to burn the candle at both ends. I haven't seen any recent statistics, but I know that on average we're sleeping almost 2 hours less than we did 30 or 40 years ago. That certainly, you could parallel that with the rise of obesity and certainly diabetes as well, because those two kind of go neck and neck for sure.
How many hours do you usually recommend?
Well, I don't think there's a set number, but for the most part, going to bed as early as you can. I usually try to have everyone shoot for between 9:30 and 10:30 on an annual basis. And then usually, people rise between 6 and 7. That's going to give an average of usually between 7 to, 6.5 to 8.5 hours. I think that is a pretty good range for most people. With the summer months, you probably have a tendency to sleep a little bit less because the days are longer. In the winter months, when it's darker, you have a tendency, or you should sleep a little longer because the days, and plus you're tired because the sun sets so quick and it doesn't rise early enough either. But that, again, that yearly cycle of light change based on seasons also is affecting our weight in a dramatic fashion as well too. So usually that 9:30 to 10:30 with the median being 10 o'clock, I think that's a pretty good bedtime for most adults, unless if your work is affected by that, which is a whole separate topic.
Yeah. Well, I think Angie gets plenty of sleep then.
It's one of my main priorities in life.
Yeah, sure. Well, especially if you're training for a marathon or doing any type of activity, exercise really, I think, is really about recovery. You can only push yourself so much, and you have to spend, especially the older you get, the more recovery you need. And sleep is certainly the most important part of that. So sleep is critical to not only fitness, but certainly to the overall weight loss process.
You find that people who are on their computer, late at night or possibly watching television, does that decrease the quality of their sleep? Does it make it harder for them to wind down at night?
Yeah, I think that, you know, people get home, you know, we all have kind of, like I said, a 9-to-5, 24/7 society. So we spend a long day at school or work, we get home in the afternoon, or usually in the evening, have dinner, usually a big meal, and then we sit on the couch for a while and watch a little bit of TV, kind of waiting to get tired. I know a lot of my clients, they get this, they almost get like a second wind, usually around 8 or 9 o'clock at night, which is an indication of some very specific hormonal disruption. And the computers and TV that we are sitting in front of, it almost mimics daylight. So our release of melatonin in the brain, I'm sure most everyone's heard of melatonin before, the release of melatonin is inhibited by the light that is emitted from the TV and the computer. So again, along with that bedtime between 9:30 and 10:30, I'm usually recommending no computer or TV at least an hour before bed. Preferably, it'd be better if it was 2 hours, but I think at least 1 hour is reasonable. So if you're doing work or you're vegging out on front of the television, turn it off, read a book in as dimly lit light as possible so you can allow those sleep hormones to rise, and then you'll just, you know, gradually doze off to sleep.
This is very convicting stuff, Robert, because I think I get a second wind around 8 o'clock, like you were describing.
Yeah,
I never thought of it that way.
Yeah, a lot of people do. When you should be winding down, kind of shutting the power down, usually you kind of get revved up a little bit. A lot of people describe it as feeling wired and tired. They're exhausted, but they can't fall asleep.
Yeah.
And that is usually dictated by a hormone called cortisol. Aerobic activity and stress, which in some ways the body sees those as the same thing, you can actually raise your cortisol levels a little too much. And at night, their cortisol levels are supposed to be very low. For your listeners, cortisol is what we call the stress hormone. Now, it has a few other functions and certainly contributes to the weight gain problem, which is what I mentioned a couple minutes ago. I just said stress, but cortisol is really the culprit there. That is really what's affecting a lot of people's sleep issues, why they can't either fall asleep very efficiently, or they can't stay asleep. They wake up every, 90 minutes, or, they wake up several times during the night. It's a very direct indication that there's some kind of metabolic flaw there.
Hmm.
So we've touched on the, hormone imbalances can be hindering people's weight loss efforts. And what kind of tests can be done to see if that's an issue for a person?
Sure. Well, I think weight loss, we have to realize, like I said, it's not about calories at all. It has very, very little to do with calories. We have to kind of change our paradigm or our mindset revolving weight loss. And weight loss, or weight gain for that matter, is all controlled by hormones. Hormones, enzymes, receptors, genes, all those things are what control the weight gain, weight loss process. Some of the tests that I run typically are looking at things like insulin, which everyone's probably heard of before. Glucose, of course, which I don't really put a lot of emphasis on blood sugar, which is what glucose is, because I think that it is a little bit of a, it's a little ambiguous. It doesn't tell you a lot. Some other inflammatory markers, one's called CRP, another one is called hemoglobin A1C, which is a very common test for diabetics. Hopefully this is not flying over everybody's head, but I also look at sex hormones, so testosterone for men, female hormones for women, thyroid, and there's several other ones, but those are some of the basic ones.
Yeah, that sounds good. I think, a lot of people probably think they're doing everything right, but it could be something that really is out of their control if they have some kind of imbalance in one of these areas. And it seems like, the body is trying constantly to keep itself in balance. So if one thing is off, it's going to kind of throw other factors off. And so it's probably a good idea at that point in time for a person to seek professional help. What is the point where you feel like people should seek an expert to help with their weight loss?
Well, it should be, depending on how long they've been overweight. So if they've been overweight for a long time, then absolutely don't try to do it yourself and find someone to help you. Just because you'll be, trying to climb uphill backwards, it'll make it that much more difficult. And you want to rule out what you just said. You want to make sure that there's not any kind of organic problem. And like I said, if you have been overweight, for a long period of time, or you have put on a substantial amount of weight, it's a pretty much a guarantee that you have some type of metabolic issue, whatever that might be. There's a few, common patterns that I see, and they can be addressed, relatively easily. The other one is if you've tried something, try to program or a process or a routine, whether that's nutrition and or exercise, and you're just not necessarily seeing the results that you want. Don't wait too long. If it's been a few weeks or even a couple of months, I would seek out that help right away. However, the only caveat I would say to that, do your due diligence when you're trying to find a provider or a healthcare practitioner, because a lot of them, unfortunately, they still subscribe to the same eat less, exercise more mentality. So you could be going to a healthcare practitioner, but if they believe those types of things, they're going to be, hurting you more than they're going to be helping you. So the best way to do that is if you ask them if their program or nutrition is caloric based on a certain amount of calories per day. That's the big red flag that they don't really know what they're talking about, and it's time to look for somebody else. I don't have any of my clients or patients count calories at all because I think it puts the focus on the wrong thing.
Well, that's good because it's tedious to count calories.
Yeah, right. It's a real hassle, and no one really wants to do it anyways. And the example that I give is that animals in Mother Nature don't count calories, but they're not overweight. Their own appetite and metabolism regulatory mechanisms are intact. And that's really, in a sense, what I'm trying to do with people is trying to rewrite, so to speak, their own regulatory mechanisms so they can control their own habits and behaviors, as opposed to trying to do it, based on calories, because that'll always backfire, 9 times out of 10.
So if you were to map that out, if somebody who is overweight comes to your office, and obviously we know how you believe now about calorie counting and the traditional approach to weight loss, what does it look like then for somebody who you help lose weight?
Well, unfortunately, it's still based on food. First and foremost, it's based on food. We have to look at food as almost information for the body. Mm-hmm. As I said a few minutes ago, food, barring any drugs or supplements or anything, food has the most profound impact on your hormones. So you can use food when done in the right way to substantially affect your hormones either in a positive way or in a negative way. I have kind of a three-phase approach, phase one, phase two, phase three, depending on where their starting point is. It's all based on their starting point. If someone needs to lose 100 pounds, they go to phase one. If someone needs to lose 10, 15 pounds, they go to phase three. And it's just a different level of aggressiveness based on where they are. There's some common themes all the way through, but it's kind of a graduated process as opposed to a one-size-fits-all, no matter where they're starting from. Because let's say, for example, a woman, a 42-year-old mother of two, wants to lose, 10 or 15 quote-unquote vanity pounds. Comparing that to a 50-year-old gentleman that needs to lose 70, if they take the same approach, let's say the more aggressive approach, the woman will more likely get to where she wants to go, but it'll only be setting the larger man up for failure. And again, usually everyone I see as well, too, is we do some preliminary blood work to make sure that there's no other issues that we need to deal with before we get started as well, too. So based in food, but we're also fixing some other issues, whether that's improving liver function, which is has a huge, that's probably, besides your muscles, is your number one fat-burning organ in your body. If your liver doesn't work right, your body won't burn fat. So that is probably a large percentage of what I'm doing is in restoring liver function, which, again, that doesn't necessarily ever show up on a blood test necessarily, but people still have a lot of liver problems. Improving the efficiency there is only going to make their success rate that much higher.
Is there an optimum amount of time that meals should be spaced to assist with weight removal?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and something that I focus on the most. Okay, with my clients, I use food as an appetite suppressant. And now that sounds a little bit counterintuitive, but you want to stay really one step ahead of your biochemistry. The typical pattern that everyone usually has, again, in the 9-to-5 society, whether they're a student, a stay-at-home mom, a busy professional, doesn't really matter. We have a tendency to not eat enough food in the morning for breakfast. We either skip it, we have something carbohydrate driven, maybe we have some coffee, cereal, fruit, maybe a bagel, something along those lines, you know, those healthy whole grains that everyone talks about. Mid-morning, we probably have something more of the same thing, maybe some more fruit, maybe some more carbs, maybe some more whatever, maybe nothing at all. We get to lunch. Lunch is usually a fairly big meal because we're so hungry by the time we get to lunch. People get back to work or whatever they're doing within about 90 minutes. They practically need to lay down and take a nap and fall asleep. That gets them through the end of the day. And then they actually want to, they get home. They're starving again, ravenously hungry, and they eat another huge meal. Okay. So if you look at that kind of on a diagram or a chart, most of the caloric intake is coming in the second half of the day, usually from 11 o'clock on. So what I try to do is I help people flip that process around. So most of their caloric, quote-unquote, caloric density for the day is coming in the first half of the day. Breakfast, let's say 7 o'clock. Usually I recommend that you eat within an hour of waking up, if not sooner. And then you're on basically every 2 to 3 hour schedule after that. So it's very easy to plan out your day based on that first morning meal. But the first morning meal needs to be fairly substantial as far as how much should be somewhat protein driven. And then you can space out or schedule out your meals for the rest of the day. And we live in a society with the food abundance that we have is that no one has to plan their meals. Okay, we just eat when we're hungry. But usually we're so busy, we have so much, we have such a lack of time. That's really what the stress is that I referred to, that we go hours and hours and hours without food. And then when we finally do eat some food, we're eating way more than we should. We eat a huge portion, and that alone, even though at the end of the day we might be consuming less calories per se on that total day, but because the meals are so dense and we're eating all those calories in one or two meals, it sends our hormones, particularly that insulin that I mentioned and cortisol, it causes some disruption and some imbalance. And that's what sets the stage for continual weight gain and the inability to lose it, you know, once someone tries an exercise program or a weight loss program.
I think I've also found that people who don't intentionally plan the mini meals they need to be eating during the day, they tend to, you know, it's the snack machine at work or someone has a jar of candy available, and if they're not being intentional, they get to that point where they're starving. It's kind of like you just look around and start inhaling whatever's around you, which usually isn't the best choice.
Yeah, that's your brain going into default. Especially if you're engaging in any type of exercise, any type of activity whatsoever, you really need to eat way more food than you ever thought was possible, because you're expending more energy. You need to give your body that much more energy. And if you're eating, for the most part, a non-processed food diet, a whole food-based diet, it's shocking to people actually how much food they have to eat on a daily basis. And the minute that you don't, just like you said, Angie, the minute you don't, your cravings kick in. All those thoughts of all those yummy foods kick in, and you're pretty much powerless over it. That's why, you know, the weight loss process has nothing to do with willpower. Willpower does not exist in Mother Nature. It's kind of a pseudo, sociology or psychology term that doesn't really apply to our own biochemistry.
Have you found that there are any foods that assist with weight loss? You've been talking about, you know, non-processed foods, foods that are as close to their natural state as possible. Give us a few specifics of what good foods would be to eat on a daily basis.
Right. A lot of controversy as far as, what we're supposed to eat. I think that there's this idea that we're all meant to be vegetarian in order to be healthy. And I think that works for some people, but I think it's the very small minority of people. Now, I'm not pushing any kind of one way or another. I think you can always find balance based on your own preference. And there's some ways to determine what that preference is. I think that protein and fat should be the kind of the predominant dietary, sources of calories on a daily basis, because for one, they're very, at least fat anyways, is very satiating. The good healthy fats, you know, the omega-3s, the good oils, you know, those types of things, the nuts and seeds. Your brain is always looking for a source of sugar or a source of fat. So if you give it all the fat that it wants, it doesn't look for the sugar as much. So what people do a lot of times, they go on a diet, they that automatically will reduce the amount of fat they consume. So automatically then it, on the flip side of that is it just increases their sugar cravings. And that's where people become very powerless to that fat. So protein and fat for sure. Protein probably being number one. Fat is a nice complement to that. Plus, if you're doing engaging in a lot of activity, like I said, you need the calories from the fat in order to do that activity. So your caloric intake doesn't drop too low, so you can rest and recuperate. And again, keeping those cravings to a minimum. So that's first and foremost. Then I think we get into all, of course, the plants that are out there, fruits and vegetables, not only for the calories they provide, but also the phytonutrients they provide, all the antioxidants and other nutrients that we get from them. I think that's, in a nutshell, that's what people should be focusing on.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Now, are there any supplements that you recommend to people who want to lose weight? I'm sure that, you know, with your own clients, you do the series of blood work and figure out where their deficiencies lie. Are there any kind of across-the-board things that people need to be taking to assist with weight removal?
Sure. I will say that there's not a supplement on the planet that is a weight loss supplement.
Oh, okay? Man.
There's nothing out there that works. If there was, I would use it. They're marketed well. They're positioned very well, but nothing out there that is touted as a weight loss supplement is effective at all. So having said that, number one on the board would be omega-3 fatty acids. Preferably a liquid form, either cod liver oil, a fish oil of some sort, or flax oil, depending on your preference. That's first and foremost. Why is that? Well, there's a few reasons why. Usually when someone's overweight, they are what's called insulin resistant, which is kind of a pre-diabetes situation. And omega-3 fatty acids have been shown both clinically and through research to improve someone's insulin sensitivity. What does that mean? Well, it just means that over time you reduce your insulin burden on the body, and that's what will allow you to lose weight. So that's first and foremost. Another one, if people are having significant sugar cravings throughout the day and they're really having a hard time with the Diet Cokes or, you know, whatever it might be, another one is called a mineral called chromium. People probably have heard of that before. It's very simple, easy to find. But it can be very beneficial at curbing some of those carb cravings to keep you on the straight and narrow as far as your diet goes. I don't want to give out necessarily any specific medical advice, but I will give one as far as that goes. 200 micrograms is a typical one capsule serving. I think appropriate would be to take that anywhere from 1 to 3 times a day, usually right before your meals, as an appropriate way to curb sugar cravings.
Yeah, I think I need to start taking that one.
Yeah.
Get rid of my sugar cravings.
Yeah, there's a few other ones that, again, the goal is to, I use a lot of probiotics in my practice. I use a lot of things, as I said, to support liver function, some very specific herbs and nutrients. And the goal there is to improve the body's utilization of insulin. Because that's really the problem. Insulin is the major and the only, for that matter, the only fat-storing hormone in the body. And it is also a very strong inhibitor of the fat-burning process. So if it's there, present in the body, not only are you going to keep storing fat, but you're not going to be able to burn any fat. And that's why it's so not about a calorie problem. It's more about what you're eating, when you're eating it, what you're sleeping, when you're sleeping and how much stress you have. That's what will dictate whether or not you're going to lose weight or not.
And that could be why you hear of these people who have a significant amount of weight to lose and they feel like they really don't take in that many calories a day. You know, it really doesn't take that many calories to maintain the weight. And so they feel stuck because you can't really eat any less.
Right. And a lot of times in those cases, I tell them to eat more and they're very hesitant to do it because people almost become afraid of food. Food is almost their enemy if I eat more, I'm going to gain all this weight. And that's usually not the case. It certainly is a very confusing situation for a lot of people. It seems very counterintuitive to, if you want to lose weight, just to eat less. And now, based on a lot of things that I said, you are kind of eating less calories per se, but we're not focusing on calories because there's calorie reduction built right in. But that means then on the flip side of that is you have to actually overeat of all those healthy foods, all those, what people call superfoods and the proteins and the fats, all those things, you have to actually overeat those to make the, you know, kind of raise up your metabolism and encourage that fat loss process.
Wow, this is very interesting because it does go against conventional wisdom. I've enjoyed hearing this side of the weight loss problem. I like what you said about not being afraid of food. That would be an awful way to live. I mean, food is wonderful.
It certainly is, yeah. And I, you know, I want everyone to be able to enjoy it and enjoy whatever they want. Now, that might not be in the short term necessarily, depending on what their goals are, but we do live in a society where we are blessed with having a vast array of foods and tastes and cuisines at our disposal. And like I said, there's nothing that's taboo, and I want people to have as much experience with those types of things as they want. We just have to have a little bit of a strategy behind that and to be able to make that happen.
Well, all right. We've been listening to Dr. Robert share his weight loss wisdom with us. And if you'd like to go over and check out his website, it is drrobertmackey.com. He's got an excellent podcast where he talks about weight loss. I think they do 2 shows a month. And you can subscribe to his podcast there on his website. And we're also going to have a link to his website on our blog, marathontrainingacademy.com. Well, Dr. Rob, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and letting us pick your brain and just hear the perspective about weight loss that unfortunately people don't hear out in the marketplace today.
I appreciate you having me on the show. It's been a lot of fun, and that's kind of why I'm doing what I'm doing, because I think that is a pervasive kind of mindset and approach, and I think it needs to change. Otherwise, this weight loss epidemic, especially for children, is not going to get any better. It's taken us 40 years to get to this point, and unfortunately, it's probably going to take us 40 years to go the other direction. So we have a lot of work to do.
Definitely.
All right. Well, now it is time for the quick tip. And if you'd like to get the full-length interview from Dr. Rob, it's going to be inside the Academy. And if you want to become a member, there's a 14-day trial that you can get at marathontrainingacademy.com/member. So this episode's quick tip is about running in hot weather. Angie's just going to give some really quick suggestions about how to stay safe when you're running in hot places.
That's right. I know for a lot of us, this is very fresh in our minds. So my first tip is to wear a hat or a visor in hot weather. Not only is it going to keep the sun out of your eyes, but it can also help block the sweat from running in your eyes. And generally, a lighter color is better because it will help reflect the sun's rays instead of soaking in sun like dark colors. My second tip would be to bring water or a sports drink and make sure you have a few ounces every mile. Even if you wouldn't normally bring water with you for, say, your 5-mile run, you're probably going to need it in hot weather. Now, if your water gets warm midway through your run, you can try putting some ice cubes in it beforehand. Or before a long run, try putting your bottle in the freezer, say, the night before. The fluid will start melting during your run, and it'll give you a nice supply of cold water or sports drink. My third tip is your running clothes. You want to pay attention to the fabric and the fit. You want to wear wicking fabrics, especially in the heat, and dress as lightly as possible. Make sure your clothes are also somewhat fitted, because excess fabric can cause chafing.
And I can throw another tip. If you go out and run and you come back, like, drenched in sweat, get out of those clothes as soon as possible.
That's right.
There was a day last week where I ran and I got back, and I just wore my running clothes the rest of the day because I was kind of working outside, so I didn't want to take a shower quite yet. But I got a really bad rash in a very embarrassing place. And you're like, next time, get out of those clothes. And what'd you tell me?
Yeah, you can actually get a fungal infection just by not cleaning off, getting rid of the sweat. It can cause, chafing, and also bacteria and yeast likes to grow in hot, warm places. So definitely make sure that you shower and get out of those wet, sticky clothes as soon as possible.
So there you go. We hate to end on that, but
with thoughts of rashes and uncomfortable places flooding through your mind.
Just want to say congratulations to all of you who are staying active this summer in spite of the heat, or if you live in the other hemisphere, it's in spite of the cold.
That's right.
And we want to remind you, if you want to get a free audio gift about the 7 pillars of successful marathon training, just visit us over at marathontrainingacademy.com. And please remember that you do have what it takes to run a marathon and change your life. Right on my way.